Morning, welcome to the Breakfast Club. I'm Betsy and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November the 7th, 2005. I remember being a year sober coming up here and telling my story. And I was an angry person at the time. I used a lot of F-bombs and just a lot. And my son and my husband are here, so I'll keep it rated G. But oh, you're 18 now. So, oh, but my husband, he's never heard the F word. So I'll go back from the past from what I remember today. And what I remember back then when I was growing up, what I thought about an alcoholic is so different than what I think it is today. I could not even say the word alcoholic in our home growing up. So I'll have a before, the process of recovery, and then what my life is like today. I don't have a huge drunk log. It was very short. But when I drank alcohol in high school and college, it was alcoholically. The only time I ever drank socially is when my family was with me, and I didn't want to disgrace my family. So I didn't drink a lot with my family before in recovery. And I wrote some notes because these are important things I don't ever want to forget. And they're things that I remember hearing from other people's story that I'm thinking, how did you remember that from when you were 3 or 4 years old? Well, when you're not using or smoking pot or drinking, you seem to remember a lot of things in bits and pieces. So these have come back to me. That's why I have the cards. But it's just a story, and it's my story. I've heard my story from so many people that come stand behind this podium. Different faces, different amounts, different substances, whether it's drugs, whether it's alcohol. For me, it was alcohol. It started with alcohol, it ended with alcohol, it turned into drugs and other things, but it was always alcohol. I'm going to go over, like, growing up, what are the early impressions, the things that really shaped my impressions of what alcoholism today and drinking. Number one, a stable upbringing. I had a very stable upbringing. My father did not drink, but socially they were two hardworking minorities in a pure white little southern town. They just worked hard, they did very well, and they expected us to keep our I's dotted and our T's crossed and not disgrace the family. I never saw anyone drunk in my family, even when we had relatives over. They would drink, but I never saw anyone drunk. And I got a big family. My father's one of eight. My mother's one of like 10, but then that kind of whittled down to like 8, 9. So I was very stable, I loved my parents. They were good to me. They gave me everything I needed growing up. In my first story, I wish there was something I could pull from them that I could blame it on them. But today, they were doing what they could. Hard working. We were at church every Sunday morning. We had a liquor cabinet downstairs, but it was only for show. I'd never seen anyone drunk. The only way I got an impression of drinking was from watching TV. Otis. He was the drunk person I remember from Andy Griffith, you know? He was always dirty, drinking out of a paper sack, and he was in and out of jail. Or Foster Brooks. Some of you don't even know who Foster Brooks is, but he was always dressed in a suit and would always be stumbling and could never talk straight, and he would roast comedians on the Dean Martin show. And those were the only experiences I had of what drunk was. And then another important experience in my life was I was in the fifth grade. I was about 11 years old in 1974, and my 14-year-old brother, who was the oldest in our family, he got hit by a drunk driver and was killed. It was a little after midnight. I still remember the name of the man. He was a 55-year-old gentleman from a neighboring town. And I found out the next morning that he got out of jail from paying a $50 fine. And that was that. And from that day forward, my mother would tell us, no matter where we were on a Friday night, you better get in before midnight, that's when the drunks come out. Wherever you are, when I was off at college, before, be sure you get home before midnight. That's when the drunks come out. So those were my impressions. An alcoholic drank out of a paper bag. They were in and out of jail, like Otis. Or they stumbled all the time. They couldn't stand up straight. They couldn't get out. They burped all the time. They couldn't complete a sentence. And that wasn't me. And from personal experience, the other impression I had was that they drank late in the night and they got in a car and they killed people. That's what an alcoholic was. And I was not that. So, and because of my religious upbringing, alcohol was not illegal. It was not immoral. We had it in our house. Like I said, we had a liquor cabinet. And then another important milestone or memory growing up is the first time I ever tasted alcohol. This was 2 years after my brother was killed by a drunk driver. And I was 13. We had the liquor cabinet. It was like Christmas time. And you know, you get a week, the kids get a week in between before they go back to school. And my relatives from Washington, D.C. had come over, and the adults were upstairs, and my brother was somewhere, and my sister was somewhere. And I remember being curious about those pretty bottles and the alcohol in the liquor cabinet. Because I remember, you know, when things expire, you throw them out, like the bottle of ketchup or whatever. But these bottles stayed the same. We never threw them out. There were beautiful bottles with dust collecting on them. I'm like, what is so special in that these never expire? We never replace them. It's the same bottles every time. And so I thought, I'm just going to try. I want to see what is so interesting about drinking that we would protect and never throw out these expired bottles. So I opened up, got the prettiest bottle I could find, and it was like this. It looked like a red cell. It was concave. And I don't know what it was, but I opened the bottle. I remember not, and it was down in the basement. Everybody was upstairs. I was by myself. I was bored. It's like, okay, let's go find something to do. And I don't remember thinking, ooh, this smells bad. And I remember drinking it. And I don't remember thinking, ooh, this burns, or ooh, this tastes good going down. All I remember was hearing, I ain't going to go to mine, the money, I know, I was in my bed, and that was my grandmother. I heard her running around in the basement saying, oh, you know, just going, and then she'd go upstairs and I'm like, what is all the commotion? And I got up, I looked at my bed, I got up out of bed, and my room was a wreck. Everything had been pushed over. I stumbled and walked into the basement over to the playroom, you know, where all the kids play, and everything was knocked off the shelves. We had like little knickknacks on the shelves. They were all on the floor. Things were knocked over, like a fireplace with the brands and stuff was knocked over. And we had this glass coffee table, cocktail table in there, and we have since replaced the glass. But I remember looking at it, and it was out of the frame on the rug, shattered into a million pieces. And I'm looking at that, and I'm not even connecting what I had done last night. I'm like, who came in here and did this? I can't believe this. I'm still hearing my grandmother yell upstairs. And I remember thinking, that is so awesome. All those little pieces of glass perfectly intact in a rectangle. That was what was going through my head. Not the fact that it was messed up. It's probably tempered glass or something. You know, that's crazy. I did not relate the two. So that was, and then I go upstairs, and my dad looked at me, and he said, go get the rake. He called my brother, he said, go get the rake. I'm like, oh, S, here it comes. And he said, go out and rake the front yard. I'm like, what? Rake the front yard? It's December. You don't rake, you don't even mow in the wintertime. So he sent us out to rake the front yard. I'm raking, throwing up every few minutes. Raking, we're raking grass. There's nothing there. I'm like, he wasn't upset. I mean, I could tell it in his tone. He said, go rake the front yard. So we raked the front yard, and I'm finally like stable enough to walk. I think he sent my brother out there so my brother would hold me up and I wouldn't like pass out. make sure I got back up if I passed out in the yard. So we go back inside, and I'm standing there in front of them, kind of doing this. My brother walks on, and they're all looking at me, and my father just said, he didn't say anything negative, he just said, "How shameful. Look at yourself." And didn't say anything, and I walked back downstairs. I remember thinking, he hasn't even been downstairs to see what was downstairs. All I remember is that what he sees now was shameful. And I wasn't even throwing up in front of him. That set the pattern. That's when I was 13. That set the pattern for what I thought about drinking. And I thought, I've got to manage my outcomes better. I got to manage my consequences better. It wasn't the drinking. It was the outcomes, the consequences I needed to work with. So that was my pattern of drinking. That was middle school? I got into high school. And when I drank, I had to make sure I was not going to drive. I was make sure I would be drinking in a house and not our house so that they could not see consequences. If I was going to mess up somebody's house, it was going to be not our house. I never mixed drugs and alcohol because that'll kill you. And drugs were illegal. I dated guys. We'd stop somewhere and they'd snort something looked like NutraSweet on a spoon, and I'm like, that is nasty. They said, you want some? I'm like, no, that is so bad for you. And I was just, would drink. So I didn't do that. When I got into college, it was the same thing. I only drank when I would not have to drive, and my sister would invite me over to her college, and we would party, and she always hooked me up with some date. So I always had someone driving for me, and I would start out, we'd go to these great events and get all dressed up in all these wonderful big brother, big sister, little sister sorority fraternity things, and I would remember these wonderful starts, but I just never remember the end of them, how they finished. I remember a lot of interesting things, but I just never remember how they finished. So I always thought, drinking's great, there are no problems. I only remember the good part. I don't remember, literally, any of the bad part. So that was drinking. I thought that's how everyone drank. No big deal. Through college, I never drank before a test. I never drank in class in the morning. It was external things that kept me from drinking. It was never, oh, I better not drink. I think this is bad for me. It was always something outside of me. And where I went to college, I lived in the dorm on campus, and right across the street was the student center. And every Friday night, they had a student center sponsored keg party, and it was free. And I was there every Friday night, and I would just walk home. It was just a great setup. And you're not going there. Don't worry. So that was my pattern of drinking. As long as I controlled the consequences, I was fine. I was not an alcoholic. Then another significant experience is I got saved in college. I went to church one time, and I liked what I heard, and I became a professed Christian. And I stopped drinking altogether. It's not because I thought drinking was a sin or anything, but I had found something to replace what alcohol used to give me, like a freedom and a joy and a happiness with a fellowship of people that I really enjoyed. We went on vacations together. We served together in the church, out of the church, volunteering, doing all that regular stuff. And I just never had the desire to drink because I had found fun. I met the man of my dreams and married him. And to that point, everything I had imagined in the fairy tale life I was living, thinking I was living, had come true. I met Prince Handsome, and we got married, and that was that. And I thought, okay, that's life. Now, what's next? Okay, what's next? I knew we had talked about wanting 6 kids. So we started off on that track. And we tried and tried and tried, and it just wasn't happening. We knew how to try to have kids. It just wasn't happening. That part we knew, it just was not happening. So I got fertility treatments, and all we wanted was children. I thought, children, that's just my dream. They will make me who I am. They will give me the identity, just like my parents from huge families. You are who your family is. And finally, after 6-7 years of fertility treatments, I gave birth to twins. And just as I had imagined, I want one that looks just like my husband, little white baby, and then one like me that's like a little Latino Asian baby. And they look just like that, real bright, 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 and then dark, dark, dark. So that was a real significant event. And I remember when they were 2.5-year-olds watching them out, play in the yard, and still thinking, is this it? Is this it? So now what? I got the Prince Charming. I got the house. I got the cars. I got the kids. One that looks like him, one that looks like me. So now what? And I didn't think about drinking then. I was tired all the time. I didn't sleep well, you know, running after the kids. And I thought, now what? And things were miserable temporarily. And it was just because I was tired. When I think of HALT now, hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, it was the same when I wasn't drinking. I would be irritable, restless, and discontent when I was hungry, angry, lonely, and tired when I was not drinking. And then another significant event in my life is that I was watching the kids in the yard. They were about 4.5. My friend drove up to the driveway, stopped the car and parked, and she was coming to pick up her son I was watching. And we were talking, and all of a sudden her car that was parked started rolling out of the driveway into the street. And then she got it to stop, and I looked over, and one of my sons, the one that looked like his dad, Bryce, was lying in the grass and bleeding from his mouth. And so I ran over there, and I thought, okay, oh my God, he's not breathing. So I resuscitated him. I attempted to resuscitate him, and he just bled right there to death. And his brother was on the front porch watching this. And I remember staying sober through the events of going to the wake and having people over to the house to visit you and give you their condolences. And I remember hearing people talk. I remember all that and hearing somebody ask my husband, do you want me to get her something to sleep or like a tranquilizer or something to help her? And he came over and asked me, and I said, no, thank you. I want to remember all the faces I see here today, and I want to remember all the feelings that I'm going through. And then came the day of the funeral. I thought, you know, we're going to have a lot of people over. They're coming to the house afterwards. So I got a bottle of champagne, and I poured a little bit in the punch we were serving, and I drank the rest of the bottle. And I thought, that was just to calm me down so I don't lose total composure. My husband was there to hold me up during that. And from that funeral forward marked the day that would change how I understood and related to the God of my understanding. Up until that point, what I thought was a pretty fairy tale life was just that. I was a believing Christian, going to church, going to Bible studies, taking good care of my kids, volunteering here and there, praying regularly, studying the good book. And I also thought, well, when I do all those things afterwards, if I continue to do those things, the feelings and the memories of that traumatic incident will just pass away. I got busy with church. I got busy with my son's school and volunteering for things, volunteering outside the home in the community. And when all the slots were filled at the PTA or VBS or whatever, somebody else was taking care of it, I would drink when there was nothing else to do. That's the only way I could get rid of that feeling. And this was how my shift in my relationship to my higher power changed. I thought, you know, if somebody I love can get killed from drinking just as well as somebody getting killed when nobody's drinking, what's the point in not drinking? Made no difference whether I drank or not. Somebody I loved was going to get killed. relating that story from my brother and then my son from a car that nobody was in that happened to roll back and kill him. Nothing alcohol related. So that was my rationale. That was the best of my thinking back then. I numb the pain because with alcohol, and it did for me what I could not for myself and what I thought God was too slow in doing, removing the pain. From that point forward, looking back on it, I didn't think then, but looking back on it, there was a marked progression in drinking. First, it was like a little wine on holidays, birthdays, funerals, weddings, maybe, and then the weekend, just the weekend, or maybe on vacation and just a little wine. Then it was like, oh, first day of school, okay, last day of school. Oh, you made an A on your paper. Great, let's celebrate. Okay, Friday, well, and then kind of Monday, it's like, oh, I've had a hard Monday. We got over the Monday, let's celebrate. It's like, okay, you get to Wednesday, it's hump day, yay, let's celebrate. And then you hole out through Thursday, and it's Friday again. And then just this pattern of, then it was, oh, it's a sunny day out, let's celebrate. Oh, my eyes are open, let's celebrate. It went from that, from wine, and then it turned into vodka because it was clear. And I mixed it in sippy cups that you'd get from like Applebee's or somewhere, and it just had the logo and a little nice cup and the straw sticking out. I would put that in there, and surely nobody would think anything, but I had my little sippy cup. We had a crystal decanter in our dining room, and it had vodka in it that's clear. And I would siphon that off, and it would start going down. So I'd fill it back up with water. And I thought, oh, that's normal. Everybody does that. No big deal. Then I started looking toward higher concentrations of alcohol. You know, I thought wine didn't do it, beer didn't do it, champagne didn't do it. I started looking at, I no longer was looking at the color. I was looking at the number at the bottom of the bottle, you know. Beer was like, what, 1.2, 0.9, 9%, 12%, then I'm looking at 30%, and now when something said 80 or 90 proof, I'm like, okay, I'll go with that. I couldn't find anything higher than that but rubbing alcohol, and like, that was just not fashionable. So I hid those in the house, and then it only escalated from there to drugs, controlled substances. Legal, they were legal. I did not do anything illegal. I only did legal drugs that were FDA approved. This is my thinking. Taking care of people, helping them out of their pain. I rationalize, I'm in a lot of pain. I'm in a lot of emotional pain. I deserve this. They haven't even been through what I've been through. So I thought, this is great. Forget the bottles. Forget going somewhere. I could hide this stuff in my bra, in my sock. And they're controlled substances, and they're called that for a reason. And I thought, I'll use them legally, and I will control them. Crazy. Now, the changes in my physical progression. I needed more and more and more to get high, is what it boiled down to. Just physiology. You take somebody who, that's why doctors don't want to give you any more than a certain amount. Whether you're an alcoholic or not, your body's going to develop a little bit of tolerance. You're going to need more and more and more each time. I noticed that, but I thought, no big deal. It's not anything different. Mental obsession. If I didn't have something to use, I was irritable. I was cranky. I was in a panic. I dreaded everything. I had intense sadness and fears. So, and then I would start planning our vacations around the alcohol. We couldn't go on vacation unless there was a time where I could drink and someone would be there to pick me up and I could just sleep it off the next day. And they remember those. The spiritual. Drinking and substance abuse never led to any outward defiance toward God, like acting out where people could see. So I thought I was fine spiritually. But inside there was a real inner bitterness toward God. There was a hopelessness. There was an anger. There was an anger. And behaviorally, I started communicating with my friends a lot less, talking with them less. I withdrew from activities at the school. I was down to the bare necessities of getting lunches ready and even getting myself bathed maybe every 3 days and barely washing clothes. And I remember saying this, what's the use? What's the use? What's the use of all this? Same thing. I'm sitting on my front porch with my two lovely kids. Same thought years later. What's the point? What's the use? And I remember that panic that I didn't have it, and I thought, I don't even want to use. I don't want to go through the trouble to go get it. I don't want the trouble of having to get dressed and go get it and do something. It's like, I don't want to do it, but I had to do it because I was starting to feel shaky, flu-like symptoms, headaches, going to the bathroom all the time. It's like a real flu. That's what the drug withdrawal is like. I wasn't quite shaking, but I thought, I have to have it to stop all this physical pain. But I remember not wanting to do it, but having to do it. I realize now that that was loss of control, total loss of control. I was doing what I didn't want to do, and I had no control over it. Then my work started suffering. This is important because my boss came up to me and she said, I can't let you work here until you go to rehab. I'm like, what? What in the world for? Really? Rehab? She said, yes, it's starting to affect your work. And you can't work until you go to rehab. And then she looked at me and she said, besides, you've got a son to take care of. And in all that time, that was in 2005, I had a little glimpse or a little bit of clarity, thinking, oh my God, I do have a son to take care of. And this is what was going through my head. If I lost that son, the one son I have left, I don't know what I could find to remove that kind of pain. It would have to be so much more than what I was doing already. And the only thing I could think of would be to be dead, to not think of that. That was a very sobering thought. So I couldn't go back to work. I talked it over with my husband. We thought, okay, this rehab thing. Let's think about that. Let's time it so I didn't have to drive carpool. I had a carpool of 6 kids on a regular basis. So I said, let's check me in Christmas, Thanksgiving. I'll be in there, in and out of there a week. Then I'll be fine. They'll fix me. I'll come home. So I did that November 7th, 2005. I checked in with one bag of clothes. Thought, okay, let's just get an A in rehab and go home. And I saw 4 holidays while I was in rehab. That amounted to about 6 weeks. I had difficulty in rehab following directions. And I don't understand it. And I look at my son sometimes, and he'll have difficulty doing what I tell him to do. The clothes are still on the floor. I'm like, and I remember those days that I couldn't do what they asked me to do without a bad attitude. I just remember doing it thinking, if I'm going to get out of this, if I'm going to bust this joint, I've got to get an A in rehab. And I better do what they tell me to do. Somebody had an issue with, oh, you think you're what you make yourself up to be with your makeup and you look lovely. And I said, yeah, what of it? So my psychiatrist said, I want you to go one day without any makeup. I'm like, what has that got to do with the price of eggs in China and my drinking? I didn't say that to him, but all he said is, can you do it? I didn't say, will you do it? He said, can you do it? And I thought, oh, that's a big difference. can you do it? I'm like, sure, sure. So I did that. And that led to the progression of learning how to follow simple directions. You ate when they told you to eat. You slept when they told you to sleep. I could not do that on my own. I had to be taken out away from my family to do what someone told me to do. So I really admire people who bypass the rehab and they come straight in here because someone told them. That just blows me away. I had to be removed. It's like I had to have the taser on my neck and say, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. That's what it felt like. So I followed directions. I got an A, and that was, I left that place, and that was the formal rehab, getting sober. When I left, I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I had to get a sponsor. I did that. I had to call every single day to see if I was going to be chosen for a drug screen, random drug screen. And if it came up positive, you're going to have to go back into that place. So I did weekly support groups, mandated, and I wrote quarterly reports on my progress in recovery. And I did all this for 4 years, calling every day for 4 years, going to meetings. And that was the real process of the inner recovery that began, was that part. The rehab part was breaking the horse part. Until I was broken, I wasn't going to do any of that. So I kept going to meetings. I would take what I heard in the meetings and try to apply it at home. I started working the steps with a sponsor. And when I say working the steps, we would get together, we would read out of the book, and we would say, okay, what's that principle? What do you think about that? We would discuss it, and they would share what it meant to them to me. They didn't tell me what to do. They would share what it meant to them. And like, okay, some of it I could identify, some of it I couldn't. I began to ask questions about other problems in my life. And through the rooms of AA, I learned how to ask for help outside of myself, from another person. Then I began to develop the trust in a person, a loving person, people who were as imperfect as I am. I learned to recognize my feelings and what caused those things, and that's in the fourth step. You write down all these things, and these things you're upset, and you try to pinpoint why you're so upset about them. And I didn't realize that drinking was just a habit that I use. So I went through all that. I just drank to escape emotionally. Don't get me wrong. Today I'm in recovery, and I'm still emotionally unbalanced sometimes. I'm not perfect. But I don't have to drink and drug today over those imperfections and expectations that don't come through. There's a place in the book on 98, 99 that I always like to remember. And then when I heard it, I thought, oh, wow, that's novel. On page 98, let no alcoholic say he cannot recover unless he has his family back. This just isn't so. In some cases, the wife will never come back for one reason or another. And I remember thinking, well, I know my son's not coming back. Remind the prospect that his recovery is not dependent upon people. It is dependent upon his relationship with God. And I learned how to relate to God through these rooms. I got a different perspective of who God was. He was the same God, I think, as the one I grew up with, but from a different angle. From the view of the woman at the well. If you don't know who the woman at the well is, well, okay, you can ask somebody. And as I kept coming into these rooms, I saw God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I saw God doing for me what not another human person could do for myself. No human power. We like to say that in here, and it's true. I saw God doing for me what no man, no child, no outlet mall, no church, no shoes could do for me. God did for me. And that to me is spiritual. it's not something I can lay hold of physically, tangibly. It's the unseen. That's why we call it spiritual. And people don't like spiritual. It's really just the unseen. So most people are spiritual. They just don't believe it. Today I believe it very clearly because I hear about the wonderful things that God's done in people's lives. Where I am today, I've heard this in rehab and it's true today. Meeting makers make it. Meeting makers make it. Today I accept powerlessness. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I'm okay with being powerless over drugs and alcohol. I used to not be able to even say that, but I'm okay with that. I accept that today. No big deal. If I'm powerless over it, I have shown over the years no amount of trying to work around it in the circumstances will ever make me powerful over it. To me, powerless over drugs and alcohol is not helplessness. To me, it is not hopelessness. To me, powerless over drugs and alcohol is not weakness. It doesn't mean I'm limited in my abilities. To me, I'm freed up, actually. I have more power and energy today that I don't burn up uselessly trying to control the drink and get it. I don't have any power over it. Today, I have a lot of power in looking at the talents and the abilities that I have that I thought were defects. I've learned through these rooms how to change them into assets and use them for good. I'm, you know, still working on that, and that's just a lifetime process. I don't think about the drink or the drug as a solution anymore. That doesn't mean it won't ever come back. Powerless means powerless forever. There's not a time that I think I ever can ever have it and I'll be okay. We have two bottles of wine sitting in our house right now, and I look at it, it's not speaking to me anymore. My family and all the friends we had before, they drink the same way they drank before. They don't drink alcoholically. Some get drunk maybe on New Year's Eve, Christmas, and that's that. So I don't resent them that they can drink normally. I'm like, great. They don't have that crazy obsession, that powerlessness when you think you're powerful over something that I have, and that's all right. I love alcoholics. They have a lot of power and talents and gifts. And it says in here, most alcoholics have a higher than average work capability. Anyone who could do the jobs they did, totally stoned, totally drunk. That is determination. Can you imagine that person was sober? What you can get out of them? So that's my life today. Sobriety requires a lot of footwork for me. I go to meetings. I'm aware of my feelings. When I go to meetings, meet with a sponsor, talk to sponsees, stay connected, I'm humbled. I'm really humbled. And with that humility, I'm able to recognize spiritual things more. When I'm not humble, I don't recognize anything. The more humble I am, the more I'm able to recognize those unseen things. Today I see how God has given me everything that I was always looking for, a serenity of spirit. A spirit that was not hampered by anything, but was turned into a better use. The God of my understanding is a loving God, forgiving God. He or she, that loving higher power, brought me out of something that I couldn't get out of, that I was powerless over. Today, I am not relieved of the bondage of self. I still go through bouts of selfishness, and as long as I'm living, I probably will go through bouts of selfishness. I share at meetings, I talk to sponsors and sponsees, and I understand God in a way that I never could understand Him before. So And that's my life today. I finally found something I could not conquer. And it just gets better and better. Every time I hear somebody's wacko, jacked up story, I'm like, wow, that is so crazy. But only a drunk could pull that one off. Only a drunk. You know, and we'd get together for, and I'll finish up with saying that I really do love alcoholics because they're very creative. The things they do to get their drink and their drug. And I like to read the morning paper, and I'll read all this crazy stuff. This person got shot, this person got run over, this one. You know, bad stuff is happening all the time, and sometimes there was no drink involved at all. And that's just life. Bad stuff happens. And the people in these rooms and the God of my understanding show me how to handle the bad stuff that happens with grace and with dignity. I mean, when you lose children to this disease, how do you handle that? How do you handle that? And when you come in these rooms, you will see a lot of people die. You'll see a lot of people go out and never return. I never knew that really happened until I came in here. And I don't want that to be me. So I know on the outside when people die, somebody dies, someone says, oh, I feel sorry for you. In here we say, well, I'm glad it was them and not me. And that's the truth of it. I'm glad it was them and not me. And the only way I know for it to be not me is to do what they told me before. Go to meetings, continue to pray, and make a conscious contact with your higher power, because you can't be my network that goes with me all the time. And when you're not, that's when my higher power comes in, and it has worked since, and I'll just keep doing it. So thank you for letting me share that story today.